Message is from the House.
February the 20th, 2012, from the House of Representatives, message number 5. Mr. President, this is to inform you that the House has amended the House rules of the 61st Wyoming State Legislature with the following amendments. House Rule 1, amended House rule to read special rules for the budget session, suspending the rest of the reading. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk. February the 20th, 2012, from the House of Representatives, message number 110, third reading passed. Mr. President, the following bills listed below passed the House on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. House Bill 2, Service of Process Fee. Ayes 58, excused 1, absent 1. House Bill 4, Ignition Interlock Program Fees. Ayes 58, excused 1, absent 1. House Bill 25, Private Transfer Fee Obligation. Ayes 55, noes 2, excused 2, absent 1. House Bill 26, Contractor Residency Provisions. Ayes 57, noes 1, excused 2. And House Bill 38, Coal Severance Tax Industry Factor. Ayes 52, noes 6, excused 1, conflict 1. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk. February the 20th, 2012, from the House of Representatives, third reading passed. Mr. President, the bills listed below passed the House on third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill 10, Game and Fish Additional Elks Licenses. Ayes 58, excused 1, absent 1. House Bill 11, Business Entities Revision. Ayes 58, excused 1, absent 1. House Bill 12, Marketable Title Act Conservation Easements. Ayes 51, noes 7, excused 1, absent 1. House Bill 13, Wind Estate Disclosure. Ayes 58, excused 1, absent 1. House Bill 36, Paramutual Permits. Ayes 50, noes 8, excused 1, absent 1. And House Bill 52, Private Road Actions Appraisal Costs. Ayes 57, noes 2, excused 1. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Reports from standing committees.
February the 20th, 2012, Mr. President, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom was referred Senate File 54, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Dockstader, Nutting, Scott. No, Senators Martin and Schiffer. Senator Scott, Chairman. February the 20th, 2012, Mr. President, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom was referred Senate File 91, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Dockstader, Martin, Nutting, Schiffer, and Scott. Senator Scott, Chairman. February the 20th, 2012. Mr. President, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom was referred Senate File 66, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Martin, Nutting, Schiffer, and Scott. No, Senator Dockstader. Senator Scott, Chairman. February the 20th, 2012, Mr. President, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom was referred Senate File 50, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Dockstader, Martin, Nutting, Schiffer, and Scott. Senator Scott, Chairman. February the 20th, 2012, Mr. President, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred Senate File 11, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Hastert, Nicholas, Von Flatern. No, Senators Meyer and Peterson. Senator Nicholas, Chairman. February the 20th, 2012, Mr. President, your committee number 1, Judiciary, to whom was referred Senate File 24, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, and Perkins. Senator Perkins, Chairman. February the 20th, 2012, Mr. President, your committee number 1, Judiciary, to whom was referred Senate File 28, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, and Perkins. No, Senator Burns, Senator Perkins, Chairman. February the 20th, 2012, Mr. President, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred Senate File 9, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Hastert, Nicholas, Von Flatern. No, Senators Meyer and Peterson. Senator Nicholas, Chairman. February the 20th, 2012, Mr. President, your committee number 1, Judiciary, to whom was referred Senate File 46, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, and Perkins. Senator Perkins, Chairman. February the 20th, 2012, Mr. President, your committee number 1, Judiciary, to whom was referred Senate File 29, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, and Perkins. Senator Perkins, Chairman. February the 20th, 2012, Mr. President, your committee number 4, Education, to whom was referred Senate File 90, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Barnard, Coe, Jennings, Rothfuss, excuse, Senator Landon, Senator Coe, Chairman. February the 20th, 2012, Mr. President, your committee number 4, Education, to whom was referred Senate File 94, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Barnard, Cole, Jennings, Landon, Rothfuss, Senator Cole, Chairman. February the 20th, 2012, Mr. President, your committee number 9, Minerals Business Economic Development, to whom was referred Senate Joint Resolution 2, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Bebout, Cole, Cooper, and Jennings. No, Senator Rothfuss. Didn't I say amended? Oh, this one is amended. Do pass amended. Senators Bebout, Cole, Cooper, and Jennings. No, Senator Rothfuss. Senator Bebout, Chairman. February the 20th, 2012, Mr. President, your committee number 4, Education, to whom was referred Senate File 78, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Barnard, Cole, Jennings, and Rothfuss, excuse, Senator Landon, Senator Co-Chairman.
Senator Scott. Mr. President.
Yes.
Senate File 66 that was just read in, medical assistance hospice care, sponsored by Senator Perkins and others, does have an appropriation in it, and pursuant to Senate rules, I ask it be re-referred to the Appropriations Committee.
The request is that Senate File 66 be referred from Committee Number 10 to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. Without objection, it's so ordered. Senator Coe.
Mr. President, Senate File 78, just read in out of the Education Committee, Interstate Compact on Students of Military Families, does have an appropriations. We request that it be re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations.
The request is that Senate File 78 be re-referred from Committee Number 4, Education, to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. Without objection, so ordered. Senator Coe.
Mr. President, may I have privilege of the floor?
Yes, you may.
Okay, up in the balcony up here to the left, we have the Cody Youth for Justice group that is down here with an issue. And if they haven't had a chance to talk to you, let me know and I'll make sure they do. Please welcome the Cody Youth for Justice, who traveled 387 miles from Cody down here.
Well, welcome, students, and we hope that you enjoy your time. And I know one of you, and I'm sorry I'm not good at names, but you taught me a lot today in a short time. So, are there other re-referrals or any privileges of the floor? Seeing none, Mr. Majority Floor Leader, we are at that order of business. Consideration of bills on general file.
Mr. President, I move that the Committee of the Whole resolve itself back into committee, or that the Senate resolve itself back into Committee of the Whole.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. Senator Cooper, would you come back to the desk, please?
Sí, como no.
Thank you. Committee of the Whole, please come back to order. The first bill for our consideration is Senate File 35. Will the reading clerk please read the bill?
Senate File 35, sponsored by the Capital Financing Committee, Higher Education Reserve Accounts, an act relating to public funds. It was referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Hastert, Meyer, Nicholas, Peterson, Von Flader, and Senator Nicholas, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Nicholas?
When I move, when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it does so with a favorable recommendation for Senate File Number 35. And for an explanation of the bill, I turn it over to Senator Perkins.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, did you move the bill? Did you move it? Okay. Mr. Chairman, what we did, the Select Committee in the interim met and we looked at this. What we found is that what we found was probably a hole in what we wanted to be a closed system. And both the investment earnings in the reserve accounts for both the Hathaway Scholarship and the Excellence in Education Funds, what they do is, if you remember, Mr. Chairman, what happens on those is each year there's an amount of an expenditure, an amount, I think it's 3.5% in the Hathaway Endowment, I think it's 5% in the Excellence in Education Fund that spills out and is used for the purposes of those particular funds. What happens is, if any amount that's not used from the expenditure percentage just goes into a reserve account. And so what we're talking about is not the interest or the earnings on the actual Hathaway Fund or the Excellence in Education Fund. We're talking about just the earnings in the reserve accounts. And so these reserve accounts, at some point in time, if there's a shortage in one year, the expenditure percentage that comes off the fair market value of each account is insufficient to pay, then the reserve account helps make up the difference for Hathaway scholarships or for grants in aid under the Excellence in Education. All we found several years ago, what was happening is the interest and dividends that are earned off these reserve accounts. There's nothing in the legislation that specifically says that they would be retained in the reserve account and ultimately help contribute to when that goes back into the corpus or later on be used for it, or in a shortage year that it would be used to help fund the Hathaway scholarships. And so the audit department found out and said, well, if that doesn't happen, then the interest from these reserve accounts actually would roll back to the general fund. And I think it was the intent of this body's reserve accounts so that will aid when ultimately it gets to be 75% of the expenditure amount, that reserve account will tip everything over that back into the corpus of the Hathaway account or the Excellence in Education account. So what we did is, this bill simply comes back and designates that interest won't go to the general fund, but it will stay in the reserve fund. And ultimately, when the reserve fund gets to be 75%, it'll tip back in and help go back into the corpus to help for inflation proof that. And so for that purpose, it's not, if you look at the fiscal note, Mr. Chairman, it's not a lot of money. It actually decreases over time because what we think is that there's going to be more demand on these accounts, and also you'll be using the money out of reserve accounts to help meet the current obligations of both the Hathaway Fund and the Excellence in Education. So that's what this bill does, is it closes the loop and makes the interest and earnings on this. It stays in the loop and will be used for the purposes that we believe that the legislature intended it for originally, and that is it will either pay for scholarships in the Hathaway Fund or go back into the corpus, and in the Excellence in Education Fund will either go to help for the purposes of the Excellence in Education Fund or ultimately end up back up in the corpus of the Excellence in Education Fund. With that, I stand for any questions and ask for the body's favorable consideration.
Any questions on the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Nicholas's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 35, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say no. That bill has passed. Senate File 35 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 39. Will the reading clerk please read the bill?
Senate File 39, sponsored by Senator Ross, Adjustment of Child Support for an Adult Child, an act relating to child support. It was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, and Perkins. Senator Perkins, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Ross. Oh, sorry. Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I move in the committee whole rising report to do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 39. And for an explanation of the bill, I ask that you would call on our good majority floor leader.
Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 39 is a pretty simple bill. I pretty much explained the bill on introduction. Right now, the way in which child support is ordered, particularly in Section 20, Title 20, which is child support, there's a provision in the law that allows for the award of child support to go on past the age of majority or attending high school or equivalent program, that child support can go on into adulthood, and that is for children that have disabilities, special handicaps, et cetera, where that child needs to be supported. Currently, if that child support is awarded, there's no mechanism for potentially doing away with that child support or modifying it down under certain circumstances. And what we found is that there are times and it's brought to me by several judges that they've found that a child who is an adult and child support is awarded, the non-custodial parent, of course, pays child support for that child, but it can actually work to the detriment of the child. If the child was from an intact family home, that child would be eligible for benefits under SSDI, Social Security Disability. But if the child is unfortunate enough to be from a non-intact family and child support is awarded, that child support can count against that child actually receiving those kinds of benefits. And so what this bill simply does is on page 2, go in and say that the court in certain circumstances can modify that child support award if it's in the best interest of the child. And, of course, the movant, the non-custodial parent, carries the day by preponderance of the evidence that it is in the best interest of the child. So that, for instance, a child could be eligible for those benefits. Or child support could be reduced down. And the child then, there would still be child support, but they would still be eligible for Social Security disability benefits. So that's all that this does. It gives that the court a mechanism that it really doesn't have right now to modify child support for that adult child in those special circumstances. It will only affect a select few children potentially, but we trust our courts to make the best decision with the evidence before it that would be in the best interest of the child. And that's what this bill does, and I'd urge your favorable consideration.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, a real quick question for the sponsor. If those circumstances changed such that it was no longer in their interest, would it be an easy remedy then to petition to change it back? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ross.
That would be correct. Child support is always modifiable in any divorce or in any paternity lawsuit, or there's a special statute where you can award child support in and of itself without any other case necessarily going on. So, yeah, it just gives flexibility to the court.
Senator Barnard.
Chairman, I was interested on the fiscal note. It said there was the fiscal determination was indeterminable. I wondered if the senator from Albany County could comment on that, if you knew anything about it.
Senator from Laramie County, but Albany County. So, Senator Scott.
I would add one caution to the previous explanation about it being modifiable. Mr. Chairman, I've seen some of these in the course of my life. Never been involved in one personally, but yes, it's modifiable, sometimes at great expense and tribute to the legal profession first. It's not a simple thing.
Senator Ross.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think that there's any fiscal impact to this matter. This is a non-budgetary thing. I mean, it's parents paying for their children. With regard to the good senator from Natrona County, it can be expensive. But we've also provided for a mechanism also if the case is a 4D case under the Social Security Act, or if it's a non-4D case, you can spend $25 and it then becomes a 4D case, and you can have child support services do the modification for you. Now, granted, it may take longer because they have such a huge case file or load, but we have provided a mechanism for the adjustment of child support without having to hire a private attorney. But I will not dispute the good senator. There are cases that I've been involved in, because I do a lot of this work, where it's very expensive and it gets into all kinds of things with regards, particularly in the area of individuals that may be ranchers or have their own self-proprietor-owned businesses, and you have to try to figure out what their income is and what's allowable deductions, and so it can become quite involved. But that is separate and apart from this bill. It doesn't change that ground in any way whatsoever.
Any further questions on the bill?
Question.
Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Perkins' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 39, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. This bill is passed. Senate File 39 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 40.
Senate File 40, Judicial Salary, sponsored by Senator Nicholas, an act relating to the judicial branch. It was referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriation. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Hastert, Meyer, Nicholas, Peterson, Von Fladeren, Senator Nicholas, Chairman.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a due pass recommendation for Senate File 40, and I'll explain the bill. Ladies and gentlemen, there are two issues that will be floating through the budget process. One involves judicial staff, and one involves the salaries of the judges themselves. This deals with the judges themselves. With respect to the judges, by virtue of the Constitution, which is Article 5, Section 17, the legislature is required to set judicial salaries by statute. Now, within the statutes, we've made an exception when we provide for general cost of living increases that apply to all state employees. Then through the budget bill, we can provide for cost of living increases to the judges. As a practical matter, we've not provided across the board cost of living increases for the executive branch for many years, clear back to 2009. And the reason is we put almost all of our salary income into two buckets. The principal one is market pay adjustments. So we, at this point, because we have the Hay study folks providing market adjustment or a market scale of wages, all of our salary money has gone into the market pay, and the objective in that instance is to get to 91% of market. So as a practical matter, the judges historically have not received or cannot receive salary increases except through the statutes, through a statutory amendment. I submit to you that there's never a good time to raise judicial salaries. It's always difficult. In the years that I've been here, we've floated three or four statutes, and every year it's as difficult as the last and the previous. In this instance, the last time the judicial salaries were adjusted was in 2009. With respect to this bill, what we did was go through and did an analysis of what the executive branch comparable salaries would be if applied to the judges themselves. And in so doing, we concluded that if you put the Supreme Court judges on par with a director and many directors, you would justify a salary of between $150,000, and there are some directors that are receiving less depending on how many people they supervise, that sort of thing, but you're putting a range of between $150,000 and some of our directors are upwards near $200,000. We picked in that range the $165,000 as being an appropriate adjustment for Supreme Court judges. With respect to the district court judges, what we began to look at are what are comparable salaries to your highest level attorneys that are in management decisions, in the executive management decisions. So as executive managers, we've got some in LSO, we've got some in the AG's office, and we concluded $150,000 would be justified and warranted. With respect to the circuit court judges, we began looking at the higher level non-executive attorneys throughout state government, and we found a range, but the bill proposed originally $106,000, which by incidentally is more than your county attorneys are paid, more than the district attorney is going to be paid, and you'll see that there's an amendment to adjust that was adopted by the JAC that I'll bring up in a moment. So with respect to this bill, the bill essentially it acknowledges that judges are paid, their pay actually lags that of the executive branch and the LSO simply because we have the mechanism to make periodic adjustments annually through market pay and through a variety of other mechanisms. Even in a time of stagnant salaries, if we provide no salary increases, agencies can, within their own money, provide for step increases to pay employees. So if you move from one position to another, one with higher higher responsibility, you can still receive, even in this environment of no cost of living increases, increases to your salaries if your position or your responsibilities change. With that in mind, Mr. Chairman, I would ask that the amendment, the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, be read in.
Clerk, read the amendment, please.
Senate File 40, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, corrected copy, page 3, line 1.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've moved Standing Committee Amendment 1 to Senate File 40. Ladies and gentlemen, the JAC committee recommended an increase of $106,000 for the circuit court judges up to $110,000. There were motions to raise it even higher. There is an issue with respect to proportionality, and that is, are the circuit court judges proportionate to the other judges? And this was a compromise in recognizing that you still have to, besides looking at proportionality, you have to also look at what are the executive branch salaries equivalent to. And in this instance, I'd still submit that while I personally think the 110 is high, it can be justified by looking at certain executive branch salaries. If there's no questions with respect to the 110, I'd call for the question on the
amendment. Any questions on the amendment? Okay. Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Nicholas's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 40, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. Motion has passed. The motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 40 has passed.
Mr. Chairman, I
proceed on the bill.
Thank you. Back on the bill. You know, folks, I understand that you'll be called, if you support the bill, you'll be called upon to explain why in an environment where the JAC is not recommending salary increases to most executive branch employees and to school districts and to your community colleges and to UW, that we would support this, and the answer is simply because, out of fairness, we recognize that judicial salaries lag because the manner in which they're required to obtain increases, which is through a statutory process. Their salaries often lag, and, you know, folks, we're going to have judges retiring over the next few years. There's a selection process, and it seems to me that you want the best judges that you can afford to get. And while it may not be important to you at this moment, I can assure you that if you, your family, or your business ever find yourself in an unfortunate circumstance where you're called into court and you have to respond either as a plaintiff or a defendant, it makes a difference whether you have judges that are qualified and the highest quality. And at that time, you don't want an average judge. You want a great judge. And part of the commitment to getting and recruiting judges is not only are you paying them now, but are you making a regular effort on occasion as a regular process to move their salaries to at least their executive counterpart. Many of these judges we're trying to recruit come from private practice with much larger incomes than this, but they recognize that judicial service is that. It's service much like we're here to engage in service. And they expect to take salary reductions, but they still have families to feed. They still have children going to college. And if you want to get those kind of judges that are prepared to do service, fair enough. But along the line, they do need to have a salary that they can still afford to raise their, to take care of their families, to rear their children, send them to college, and they're entitled to regular increases on a basis, and it seems to me It is time to adjust theirs to simply bring them up to their executive branch counterparts. I urge your support.
Good. Senator Bebout.
Chairman. Mr. Chairman, just a question a little bit more from a history perspective is when they did the raise in July 1 of 09, how did that relate to their to the state salaries relative to our government and state government? Was it in line then? Was it above, beyond? And then also looking back to 2009, if that was sort of a starting point of the judges were at that point and the state salaries were at this point, how do they both proceed over the next couple of years? Just to get some perspective on the comparison of the two over the last 2 or 3 year period.
Senator Coe.
There's another question, if I could, of the good chairman of appropriations. When did they have completed, was it the Hay Group did the study on salaries, I believe you alluded to on introduction. How recent was that?
Senator Hicks.
Chairman, another question. I always worry when I look at these Hay studies and they make comparable cost analysis to states that are broke. When you run these studies and you look at those across the board and use some of these states as a comparable salary, what may be going on in some of the states down south of us that are running deficit budget, I don't think that's necessarily a good precedent. But I guess the real question I have is I understand, and I think we support trying to improve the quality of the judiciary. I just question, and it gets back to the good senator from Fremont County. We saw a raise in 2008. We saw a raise in 2009. And now in 2012, we're talking about a 10% raise in 1 year. And I guess my question would be, even within all the other sectors within state government, have we seen a 10% increase in the last 3 years?
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and all great questions. And I think the fundamental question is, particularly looking at the top two branches and the sizable increase comparative to the 2009 levels. In 2009, and my recollection is also in 2008, those were cost of living increases that came in automatically, is my recollection. Don't hold me to it, but they were COLAs, and so the same percentage was applied to them as was applied to state employees. Having said that, the following is true. Since about 2000, and particularly around 2000, in the late 2000s to now, executive branch employees have seen significant increases to move them to 91% of their market. And, the JAC keeps track of this, but if you look at the number, for example, of employees in the state making over $80,000, if you go back at least one administration at the beginning of my tenure on JAC, there wasn't a single employee that made more than the governor. And the list of employees above 80 and below at that time, say $110,000 for the governor, $105,000, whatever it was at the time, the list was under a page long. We now ask for the salaries above $80,000, and it takes, for executive branch employees, and ladies and gentlemen, it takes probably 15 pages. We're seeing many positions paid in near $200,000 for certain folks, director, for example, of the Department of Health, a large agency. But in terms of the salaries that you're seeing that we're proposing here, they're below many directors in state government, but not all. There are a couple of directors of smaller agencies that below, but by and large, most of the directors are at this level or higher. These present salaries are targeted on present executive branch salaries, and with respect to the Hay study applies more to non-judicial type positions because the Hay study is intended, and those studies intend to go out in the private industry, find out what salaries are paid for comparable positions. So if you're looking for a secretary, what are the private sector paying for secretaries? If you're looking for janitors, when you get to judges, there are no private sector judges. If you were to go out into the law industry and say, okay, what does an A-rated attorney make if you're trying to get all A-rated lawyers in a large firm, you're going to get a number much, much larger than what you see here. We recognize that when you leave the private practice, you leave it forever. Very difficult to go on the bench and go back out simply because it takes years to build up a practice. It takes years to get to a point where you're making a good salary. When you leave that practice, I know very few and almost no judges that are able to return to private practice. It's just a difficult thing to do. So when these good lawyers are leaving their practice, it's pretty much an end of their career decision. And what they're getting is a good salary, a decent salary, but they're also getting a retirement. They're paying into their retirement. We're paying, contributing to those retirements. But those are the things that you get. You're not going to get rich. There's no home runs. But for all practical purposes, you won't see a hay study market for these folks because we're not targeting them off what they would make in the private sector. Rather, we recognize we can't reimburse or pay judges what they might get in their private sector practice. So rather than doing that, we've gone in and targeted it off of what does a director make of a leading agency. Certainly, we can't afford to pay everybody the Department of Health's director's rate or some of the larger departments, but we can for the average target for the average. We've got lawyers being paid more than this in state government. And it seems to me that we target an appropriate level. And then that's true for the DJs, the district court judges, the Supreme Courts, and again for the circuit court judges. We began to look at what do county attorneys make, what does the prosecuting attorney for the Casper, Natrona County, and Laramie County make, and these seem to be appropriate levels to target them on existing executive salaries. And for all practical purposes, those executive salaries have seen pretty handsome increases over the last 4 or 5 years because we've been able to put money in to get those attorney generals closer to markets. So the attorney general's office, the attorneys, and a lot of the professionals, a lot of the engineers, for example, in DEQ, all those professionals have seen pretty remarkable increases over the last 4 or 5 years because of that Hay study.
Senator Scott, and then I'll go to Senator James.
Mr. Chairman, I have two reservations about this bill. Deal with the lesser one first. Frankly, I think that the judiciary at the district court and the circuit court level too probably is in some ways not doing a very good job at serving the public. And I think they have the same obligation that any of us who work for the state government have to serve the public. And what I'm talking about, I have some reservations about some things, the way that the whole civil justice system works, but that's not what I'm talking about. When you get caught sort of by accident in some legal dispute that some third parties are having, and you get served, say, with a subpoena, you ought to be able to call up the court and find out a few of the basics about what it is that your obligations are, what your remedies are if it's a major burden on you, things like that. And they sent out with the subpoena a piece of paper that is legal gobbledygook that I defy you to understand, and doesn't tell you very much. And you call up the clerks of the courts and say, what's going on here? What have I got to do? Give me a little basic information so I can be intelligent about it. And their only answer is go call an attorney. And that, Mr. Chairman, is a disgrace. It is not serving the public well. The judges need to remedy that sort of thing and be a little more open about the nature of their process to the people who get caught up by accident in this system, and not the, that's not the people that are suing or being sued, but it's the people that get sort of caught in the process of other parties fighting. I think the judges need to do a better job at serving the public that way. That's my lesser objection to this. Mr. Chairman, my instinct is to be in favor of this bill. I voted for it on introduction. But we're in a tight budget because of the natural gas situation. And we're having to be tight all over the state government. And here comes this thing ahead of the budget, big expenditure, increased to $2.4 million in the JAC. And if we've got enough money to do the job we need to in education, and I think we do, I think we're going to be all right there, I hope. If we've got enough money to do the job we need to do in the necessary support of the poor, to use the language of the Constitution, then this is a bill that I would say, okay, that's a reasonable priority if we've got enough money for those things. But if we don't, this ought to be a lesser priority than some of those fundamental obligations that we have. And frankly, I don't know how to vote in this thing, because I don't know, are we going to have enough money to fund the Medicaid program? Are we going to have enough money to take care of getting the waiting list on the DD programs in Medicaid down to a reasonable level? Those are a couple of my priorities, and I have difficulty voting for this bill without knowing whether it's taking money, Mr. Chairman, that ought to be spent on those people that have very real needs, as opposed to spending money on paying judges a better salary. It's a matter of priorities, Mr. Chairman, and the way this is coming to us, I don't know how to vote. It's a real difficult dilemma, and maybe the Appropriations Committee needs to talk a little more about whether we're going to have money for some of those other priorities or not, but that's where I'm having trouble.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question, I need to compare it back to something that I know a little bit more about, and that was when we went through the education reevaluation back in 05 and 06, one of the things that we were told is if we pay more money, we'd get better teachers. And I think I'm hearing that today. We pay more money, we get better judges. But now we're going through all this accountability stuff to see if we really have that promise back with education came true. So my question is, or my statement is, I think we've kind of learned, or I've learned since we've been here, that just because you put more money on the table doesn't necessarily mean you get a higher quality of employee. So what is the safeguard or the guarantee that we would have if we put more money on the table for these judges that we'll actually get a better judge?
Senator Nicholas.
If I may address those last three things. I'm going to start with the last one. Folks, with respect to the quality of judges, we know and we can determine whether or not we're doing right by our judges by looking at the number of applicants for the vacancies. And what we know is that the applicants are down. And more than that, you ought to talk to folks that are on the Judicial Nominating Commission. And I can tell you that they will, if you talk to them, they'll say this is of great concern, that we do need to continue moving this. But, you know, fundamentally, I think when you start looking at salaries, there's two components to salaries. One is, are you trying to get them to a level? Obviously, we will never reach the federal level. Federal judges are paying for a district court judge about $174,000 a year, courts of appeals $184,000. We don't expect to ever get to those levels competing with the federal judiciary. We can look at other judicial branches throughout or surrounding, and these salaries would be comparable to what they're paying. We know that there are, you know, we do want to attract our best lawyers into these fields. We can never replace what the best lawyers make in their private practices. But what we can do is try to say, look, this is a service we hope that you'll give up your career, and we hope that this is a passion that you enjoy to serve people. And what we'll try to do is keep you at pace with executive counterparts. And, you know, in a lot of respects, a lot of when you look at directors out there running our agencies, a lot of them have sacrificed pay. They could make more money in some careers, and some of them have made the sacrifice to come and help run state government, and you need to be appreciative of that. If nobody gives up time to run our state agencies because they're not getting paid what they would in their counterparts, it'd really be a disservice to the state. But part of the second component I wanted to say is important is that there be an ongoing exercise to evaluate salaries and to increase them. Because there's nothing worse than being just caught at one salary for now since 2009, and everybody's saying it's too tough, and we're not going to look at it. Because I can tell you, every argument, every time that I stood up for judicial salaries since I came to the session, there's the same discussion regardless of a good year or bad year. With respect to my colleague from Natrona County, I think that we should, on second reading, put on a provision to delay this increase for a year and have that debate. But regardless, we should walk away with a statute that says, even if we can't afford it this year, at least next year the salary increase will kick in because of the nature of this, of the nature of the requirement that it be done by statute. If we come back next year and our revenues are down, it's only going to be a harder discussion. But at least we ought to say, if we can't afford it this biennium or this fiscal year, we'll start it the next fiscal year. But kick them in so the judges know that, well, at least we know there's something coming down the pipeline. I think that's a discussion to be had to address that concern that maybe this year is not the right time, but at least the next fiscal year, that's a discussion to be had. With respect to the concerns about the delivery of justice, I concur fully. Remember, though, that the clerks of the court are generally elected. They're part of the executive branch. They don't serve under the judiciary. When you call a clerk, you're calling the executive branch. And they're elected in most instances. Now, the circuit court judges or the clerks, they're different. Now, they're paid through the state. But the last thing that you want as a litigant is to know that another litigant has called up your judge to discuss his problem and had a 20-minute discussion about your problem, and then you realize that the day you arrive at the court is your counterpart has had a 20-minute discussion about his problem. As a practical matter, we have to address those issues in different ways. And this legislature has been very generous to the folks. We created the guardian ad litem system. We put in millions of that. We put in $1 million. We put in access to justice money to help provide, pay lawyers for folks that can't afford. And we put money into the public defender system for people caught in the judicial system that are being prosecuted. To say that the legislature hasn't done its part would be unfair. Do I think that the clerks ought to be generally more willing to give out information? Absolutely. And I think oftentimes if you go to the clerk's office and talk to them, you'll get one answer. But I can tell you in our law practice on a daily basis, our secretaries receive 20 to 30 calls about questions just like you've described. And because of our malpractice, like everything we talked about earlier today, giving out opinions, for lawyers, you either take the case or you don't. You can't give advice out without rendering yourself exposed. And we're just like physicians. You can't call up a doctor and say, hey, would you prescribe? Got a cold, I got sniffles, would you take care of me? Doctor's going to say you have to come and see me. And lawyers are the same way. And when I see those 20 calls, I read their problems, and I can tell you that if they go to the clerk's office, they're going to say, we don't know how to help you. And if they call any lawyer is going to say, I can't make money on that. And I think to myself, every time I read one of those, there's a person that needs a simple answer and is never going to get it. And it's really a shame. But it's not an indictment simply on the legal system. Maybe it's our tort system. It is what it is. But I can also tell you, those kinds of problems are coming up with greater frequency. I think maybe it's just the nature of people don't want to solve their problems anymore. They want everybody else to solve their problems. But these questions come in at a volume that just astounds me. I have no solution for that.
Senator Ross. I'm going to find you on here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To further try to address some of the questions of the good senator from Natrona County, the clerks of the district court and the clerks of the circuit court are simply clerks. They are a repository for documents, basically. That's what they do, except for telling you when to show up for jury duty or something to that effect. They're really not able to give out legal advice. And they find themselves in this dilemma. And it's always a dilemma as to what can they say or what can't they say. Now, with regard to the district courts, and if you could call the judge and so forth, I think the senator from Laramie pointed it out. You really don't want a judge hearing necessarily facts outside of the courtroom, because they're supposed to be neutral and unbiased before the court case even comes forward, and they're only really to consider the evidence that is before them. But I do know that in this move where we're trying to help, particularly in the area of access to justice and so forth, that the courts are looking at a court administrator that could answer some of these questions and help in that regard without actually speaking to the actual judge. And so I know that that's on the judiciary's radar. They've been talking about it. We've had presentations from a well-known justice in Colorado, who is now, I think it's the Center, National Center for Legal Reform or whatever, to look at some of these kinds of questions to help the public. So it's always, it's a balancing act. So I sympathize with the clerks of the district court when they get these kinds of questions. If the questions are simply procedural, that you need to show up and this and such a date, they can do that kind of thing. But when they start giving out legal advice, they find themselves in the same situation that many lawyers do, and that is, I think, probably the largest growing area of malpractice lawsuits in the nation is legal malpractice. So everybody, the same question that came up today with regards to workers' comp and doctors' opinions. So, you know, we have to be very careful. We get hundreds of calls a day. What do I do? You know, I have to make notes if I talk to somebody now so that I know whether or not, you know, if I've answered their question, that I have that document, what I said, because I may be subject to legal malpractice lawsuit. So I hope that answers those kinds of questions to you. I mean, it's a dilemma that we face, but I think the courts are cognizant of that. I think our Chief Justice is really trying to make a move to try to make the courts more friendly and more available. And I think maybe this court administrator thing is probably going to be a potential solution to that.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, I've got one question for the project proponent or the proponent on this bill. It always bothers me when we talk about, you know, the sacrifice that the public employees make and the disparity from there between the public and the private sector. And it always reminds me of the fact is there is one big difference. The big difference is in the public arena, in the public employee sector, you usually have a taxpayer-sponsored retirement or pension program, and the private sector doesn't have that. So the question I have for the proponent is does the judiciary have a taxpayer retirement or pension fund associated with that position?
Senator Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To relate a little bit of personal experience, I had the honor for 6 years of serving on the Judicial Conduct and Ethics Commission. And I'd worked with the judiciary off and on for quite a few years before that through law enforcement. But the time I got to spend on that committee was an eye-opener. What I learned and what I discovered was, if you want to talk about people being judged, it's the judges. The scrutiny that they are under, and how, in time, it affects their personal lives and their families, it comes at a real cost. We're asking what we hope is our brightest and best legal minds to step out of their chosen profession at the peak of their careers and transition over into this challenging role as being a judge of their fellow man. And I don't think we want to be putting up hurdles or not recognizing what they're really asked to do and that cost and how it impacts them and in time really separates them from society. Every morning with the Pledge of Allegiance, we finish with the words, "And justice for all." We want the best people that we can get in there. I'd encourage you to support this.
Senator Scott.
I appreciate the explanation on the efforts that the judiciary is making to make it easier for people to understand the process and that sort of thing. And that's really the nature of my concern. I don't think the litigants ought to be getting their questions asked by the judge, but I think the others that get innocently caught up in this need to have a place where simple procedural questions can be dealt with. And my purpose is not to say that this is the reason we ought to defeat this bill at this time. Maybe in the future, if they don't get the job done, we ought to. But to encourage the judiciary that they've got some real work to do in this area. And frankly, I think they've got some work to do in the whole civil justice area. My real objection to this bill is that it's a matter of budget pride. Coming to us ahead of the budget when we don't know whether we're going to be able to afford to fund some things that, frankly, I think are more important with regard to taking care of some of the most vulnerable citizens in our society. And I have trouble, Mr. Chairman, deciding whether or not to vote for this bill this year when I know budgets are tight, and I don't know whether there's a tight we can't afford to take care of some of our other obligations, or whether there's enough money so we can take care of those. And this, to borrow a term from the Water Administration, this is an expenditure that ought to be in priority. Maybe it ought not to be in priority. I'm having trouble with that issue on this bill at this time.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Serving on the Compensation Commission and over the past 3 or 4 years and watching this Hay study come about and the importance of it and what our efforts have been and as far as our executive branch and bringing employees up to the 90 or 91 percentile. As a JEC member also, I saw us hold the line pretty hard with judiciary 2 years ago. And everybody else got their raises, bring up for that 90%, but judiciary didn't. And what we told them was, you're not that special. You need to go back, put this Hay study to work in your branch, and then come back to us with your proposal with what the Hay study discovers. So they're a year behind. So we all know the story. So here they are, 2 years later, and what the Hay study has pointed out or proved out, that this is their salary, and this is what was suggested. And so I don't know. I guess what I'm trying to say is we're running out of excuses. with this particular division of government. They went back, did what was asked of them. We held the line. We didn't treat them specially. This is the suggested pay salary increase. Now, I know very well that this is a tight budget session, but salary increases are always hard to give. I'm not one of those, Mr. Chairman, that believes that higher salaries attract better minds. Never have believed it, never will. But I also have to recognize the fact that we are in competition with the federal government. Now, that's a tough competitor. I don't think they understand what a budget is. And they pay their judges way, way too much. It doesn't change the fact that if I'm a judge and I have an option between working for as a federal judge, making $160,000 or $175,000, or serving as some type of a state judge, making quite a bit less, which way I'm going to go. I don't have to work as hard, and I get paid more. That's a tough competitor. But yet, that's the market that we're in. That's the reality of it. The Hay study was done, and the suggestion's there. They're a year behind. We need to catch them up. I'd ask for your support on the bill.
Senator Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman, I do want to answer the prior questions. With respect to the judiciary, yes, they do participate in public retirement. It used to be that the judges were paid a percentage, as they retired, a percentage of the active sitting judges. We changed that about 8 or 9 years ago, so that their old judges that retired in before the system that are paid as a percentage of salaries, they're now attritioning through, and there's fewer of them every year. With respect to the current plan, there's a contribution of about 18.8% because judges don't hit the rule 85 generally. Generally, they're only on the bench for about 12 years. There has a lot higher level of contribution, and in this instance, the judges have the highest personal contribution. My recollection is they pay about 5% of their revenue or their income towards that, so it puts in the state's contribution closer to that which is paid for by the big plan, that is the ordinary executive branch. But certainly we do contribute about 11 to 12% of their income to their retirement fund. Their fund is actuarially sound. It's in good shape. It doesn't have the same problems as the big plan. And in addition, we pay for their health insurance, as we do. So there is a benefits package that exists for these employees.
Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Nicholas's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 40, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Oops.
Mr. Chairman, just point of order. Was there a standing committee
amendment? We already dealt with that, Senator Bebot. Thank you. All those opposed say no.
No.
Okay, that has passed. Senate File 40 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration. Yes, Senator Hastert.
Mr. Chairman, may I have privilege of the floor?
You may.
Members of the Senate, we had some guests here. A few minutes ago, we had Representative Bernadine Kraft's family was in, her daughter and grandson and son-in-law. Her son-in-law is still here, Scott. They came in from Iowa to visit Wyoming legislature, and I'd like you to welcome them. And then also Terry and John Vase from Rock Springs are here visiting and watching the process. So I could welcome them to the Senate.
Yeah. Welcome to the Senate. We hope you enjoy your stay here at the Capitol. Yes, Senator Ross.
By find you on the thing here.
Okay. So that the
yes, go ahead.
So that the record is correct, because the vote was interrupted when you called for the ayes, I think that you should redo the vote on Senate File 40, calling for the ayes and noes, so that we have a clean record of that.
Okay, I'll start over again then, okay? All those in favor of Senator Nicholas's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 45, say aye.
Aye.
Excuse me. Hold it. Let me start over. I was already removed to the next, ready to move on to the next bill. All those in favor of Senator Nicholas's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with the favorable recommendation of Senate File 40, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. The bill is passed. Senate File 40 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is indeed Senate File 45. Reading clerk, please read the bill.
Senate File 45, sponsored by Senator Geis, Alcoholic Beverages Manufacturers, and Act Relating to Alcohol. It was referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture, State, Public Lands, Water Resources, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Bebout, Driscoll, Emmerich, Geis, and Hicks, Senator Geis, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Geis?
Mr. Chairman, when the Committee of the Whole rise and report, I move Senate File 45 with a due pass. And we also have a standing committee amendment. I'd like to have that read in now.
Reading clerk, read in the standing committee amendment.
Senate File 45, standing committee amendment number 1, page 1, line 4.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Geis.
I also move Senate standing committee amendment number 1. And ask for a due pass on it. This is a bill to take care of a business over in Kirby, Wyoming, alcohol beverage manufacturers, and we're adding a new section down on line 9 on page 1, section 1, Wyoming Statute 12-2-203, by creating new subsections F through H and is meant to read. Line 12 is 2002-203, manufacturing, recertifying and importing, and industrial representatives license fees. Then on line 15 under little F is A, holds a license under subsection A of this section, who is a distiller. May dispense free of charge on-site samples in quantities not to exceed 1.5 ounces, and that is a one-shot glass. And you're entitled to 2-shot glasses a day under this bill. Then you go on down on page 9, under little G, the local licensing authority may issue to the holder of a manufacturer license under subsection A of this section, who is a distiller, a satellite manufacturer's permit, which allows a permit to sell, to manufacture, produce, or not more than one satellite located within the state of Wyoming. Then you go on down on line 19, page 2, the local licensing authority may require a public hearing and the payment of additional permit fee not to exceed $100, a satellite manufacturer permit shall be subject to the terms and conditions of Wyoming Statute 12-4-106. Then you go on the next page, and it says on line 1, hours provided in Wyoming Statute 12-5-101 and the dispensing room provision provide pursuant to Wyoming Statute 12-5-201. And then line 4 is little h, purpose of subsections F and G of this section, distiller includes any person who, line 7 under little I, produced distilled spirits from any source or substance. Line 10 under little 2, Romanental 2, brew or maker's mash, wort or wash fit for distillery for the production of distilled spirits. Then you go down to line 16 under Roman number 3, may produce separate alcohol spirits from any fermented substance, or line 19 under Roman number 4, making or keeping mash or Wart or Warsh has a still in this possession or use. Then on page 4, section 2, this act is effective July 2002. Now, the AG's office, after we brought this bill out, had it in committee, they said we needed to add this section to apply with the federal law, and that is on line 9, 12, 5, 401, interest in license or permit to sell. Line 11 is no industry representative shall hold any interest, stock, or ownership directly or indirectly in any license to sell product of industry at a retail under privilege of a license or permit to sell any beverage or liquor in Wyoming or in any premises so licensed. This section shall not apply to any person holding a microbrewer or winery permit pursuant to Wyoming Statute 12.4.412. Next section shall not also apply to a person holding a manufacturing license under Section 12.2.203A to the extent he may be permitted one satellite manufacturer permit pursuant to Wyoming Statute 12.2.203. And I'd ask for a favorable vote on standing amendment number 1.
So on the amendment, any discussion? Yes.
Yes, I do.
Yes, he has moved it. Yes, thank you. This is on the standing committee amendment. Any discussion? Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Geis's motion to adopt the standing committee amendment number 1 to Senate File 45, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. Standing committee amendment has passed. The motion to adopt standing committee amendment number 1 to Senate File 45 has passed. We're back on the bill. Back on the bill.
Yes. Any questions?
There is an amendment, a committee of the whole amendment, Senator Burns. By you. Standing committee amendment, I'm sorry, not standing committee. Committee of the whole amendment number 1 by Senator Burns is here. Oh, excuse me. I'll get you. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, while you're doing that, can the clerk read in the amendment, please?
Will the clerk read the amendment, please?
Amendment Final 41, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 4.
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, I move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 45 and ask that you waive further reading. Mr. Chairman, I like this bill. I'm for this bill. I'm thrilled, and I think many of us are, over the developments of a distillery being in Wyoming, and I've been told it's the first distillery west of the Mississippi. I'm very happy about that. However, if you look on page 2, line 10, you'll see that the local licensing authority may issue a manufacturer's license. This distillery will not be the first distilled liquor manufacturer in the state of Wyoming. It will not be the only one. It will not be the first. There is one up in Sheridan. Anybody who's been to a wedding or large gathering in Wyoming, in northern Wyoming, in the past 60 years, may have tasted a local concoction called Bajunka. For the last 4 or 5 years, has been commercially prepared. It is potent stuff. The last time I drank some, I tried to take my pants off over my head. But it is a commercial enterprise, and so I didn't. They are not distillers. They import the grain alcohol and then put a proprietary concoction in there and blend it that way. So the legal definition for what they do or what they are is rectifiers, which was news to me. So all this amendment really does is add rectifiers to the distillers to be able to have the same privileges that a distiller has, or any distilled spirits manufacturer. And I also added the language about the federally licensed in order to stop little homemade illegal guys from being able to do this under Wyoming state law. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions on the committee of the whole amendment?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Geis.
I don't know if this is germane to this bill or not, and you have to be the judges was this should go on this bill or not. I would ask you to vote no on this amendment, but it's up to this body to decide what to do with it.
Any further discussion on the committee of the whole amendment? Senator Burns.
Well, Mr. Chairman, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. I don't know why a distiller would necessarily get any privileges under Wyoming state law that a rectifier wouldn't. They both produce the same product. They both produce distilled spirits and sell them, manufacture and sell them in the state of Wyoming.
Any question being called now? We are on the committee of the whole amendment. All those in favor of Senator Burns' motion to adopt the committee of the whole amendment number 1 to Senate File 45, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no.
No.
That has failed.
Division.
Division being called. All those in favor, please stand. Right. All those who are opposed, stand.
How many?
That has failed. The motion to adopt the Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 to Senate File 45 has failed. Now we are back on the bill again. Okay, question being called. All those in favor of Senator Geis's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 45, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. That has passed. Senate File 45 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 47. Will the reading clerk please read the bill?
Senate File 47, sponsored by the Select Water Committee, Omnibus Water Bill Construction, an act relating to water development projects. It was referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture, State, Public Lands, and Water Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Bebout, Driscoll, Emmerich, Geis, and Hicks. Senator Geis, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Geis?
Mr. Chairman, when the Committee of the Whole rises and report, I move Senate File 47. It's the Omnibus Water Bill. And I also have a standing committee amendment I'd like to have read in.
The reading clerk, please read the amendment.
Senate File 47, standing committee amendment number 1, page 10 after.
You'd like to move the
amendment?
Mr.
Chairman, I would move the standing committee amendment number 1 and give a vote on the standing amendment. Now we're going to start with this water bill, and there's a little bit of water in this all over the state of Wyoming. And deal before. You have this sheet out here. You can follow it. If you have any questions, why, you can come to anybody on the Select Water Committee or anybody on the Ag Committee. There's a blue book right there. We'll tell you everything we need that we know about the water project that you're interested in. So starting with page 2 of the bill, on line 3, Bighorn Regional Water Well Connection. That's is located in my district. I cover that whole district. It's $47,730,200. It's a 67 grant, and it's for pipe. It's to connect the wells of new well we have there out of Grable to the system. And they'll come up with the other two-thirds of the money. On 2313 Buffalo Northwest Pipeline, Johnson County, $365,000 design. It's a 67% loan, 33% grant, and it's for 30 years, and it's for pipe. The next one is 317, Casper Popular Transmission Line, Natrona County, $1,541,000, 67 grant, and it's for pipeline, and they'll come up with the other 33%. The next one is on 4327, Cody West Transmission Pipeline, Park County, $408,700, 67% grant. It's for pipelines, and they'll come up with the other 33%. The next one will be Fort Laramie Storage Tank, Goshen County, $600 design, 67% grant. For the storage tank, they'll come up with the balance. The next one is 338 Gillette Regional Extensions, Campbell County, $700,500 design, 67% pipeline. And what this does is connecting onto all the subdivisions around out in Campbell County tied into this main line, so it'll be a regional system when it's all done. The next one is 358 Lander Water Supply, Fremont County, $3,068,000, 50% grant pipeline, and they're coming up for the other 50%. The next one is Lovell Transmission Pipeline, Bighorn County, $67,000 design, 67% grant, and that's for piping. The next one is 373 Northwest Rural Northern Expansion Park, Bighorn. That's the first water system we put in once we created the water development system. $281,400 design, 67% grant, and they'll come up with the rest. That's for pipeline. Road supply, Converse County. $160,000 design, 67% loan, 33% grant, 33% loan, and it's for 30 years storage. The next one is 3 on 105 Sundance Storage Tank, Crook County, $712,000, 75% grant. They're going to get the balance from FEMA, which is $225,000, and that's for a storage tank. They built a new storage tank over there about 2 years ago. We had all that rain last year. It was on one of those red hills, and the tank just slid down the hill, and the town of Sundance already have to pay for the first tank. So we went with that 75% grant. FEMA's going to give them $275,000. The total in this subsection is $12,090,900. Now, the next section, we're in water development. These are rehab projects. The first one is the Bighorn Canal Rehab, Washakie County, $1,440,000, 67% grant, 33% loan for 30 years, at 4% for canal improvements. The next one is 333 Fayette Irrigation Rehab, Sublette County, $180,000, 67% grant, 33% loan, 4% interest for 20 years canal improvement. The next one is Lake Hattie Dam, Albany County, $840,000, 67% grant, 33% loan, 4% interest, 30 years, dam outlet works. The next one is 366 Lovell Canal Rehab, Park County, Bighorn, $565,000, materials grant, canal improvements. And when we do that, all we do is pay for the materials. They supply everything else. The next one is 371 Midvale Rehab, Fremont County, $945,000, materials grant, canal improvements, And this is about the fifth project we've done over there in Fremont County in Midvale. The next one is 386 Shell Canal Tunnel Rehab, Bighorn County, $1,220,000, 67% grant, 33% loan, 4% interest for 30 years. And we're going to, this ditch or canal comes through a tunnel, and they're just going to do away with the tunnel and make it a regular canal through there. Subtotal for that is $5,190,000. Now, the next part here, some of this is reversions that we haven't spent the money, and some of them are just they need the extension of time to finish up the project. First one is 39 Bighorn Regional Joint Power Pipeline. Bighorn was, they're going to revert back to the water development account $2,512,500. The bids come under, so we get to reuse that money. The next one is small water development projects, statewide, $300,000, just reauthorizing for new developments. And under for them to qualify under this, they have to have a watershed plan before they can apply. And the most they can get out of this account will be $25,000, and then they can get their match from wherever else. The next one is another small water project, statewide, reauthorizing rehab projects. The next one is the Highland Canal Rehab, Bighorn County, and this is just extending the canal because they're not going to get it done in time, so the money would revert before they finish it. The next one is the Sponsors Inflationary Fund, statewide, $300,000, time extensions, level 3 projects. The reason we put this little slush fund in there, once in a while, those bids will come in a little above what we had projected, and if we wait around for a whole nother year, well, it'll cost us way more money, then we just take some money out of this fund and go ahead and honor the bid. Next one's Grable Valley Hydroelectric, Bighorn County. We're reversing, will be 326,000 reversions. And they were looking at a hydro plant on the Lower Sunshine Reservoir up there. The next one, Sheridan Northwest, Big Goose Tank, Sheridan, time extension so they can get it finished, the project finished. Laramie Transmission Pipeline, Albany County, $3,120,000, 67% grant, 33% loan, 4%, 30 years for pipeline. Teton Village Water Supply, remember we put a project in for them 2 or 3 years ago, and after they got to looking over, they decided they didn't need that big a project, so they're going to revert $2,394,500. Dollars go back into the water development account. The next one is South Laramie Water Supply, Albany County, $461,380, 65% grant loan, 14 grant, that's for pipeline. The next one is Heart Mountain Rehab, Park County, $485,000 material grant, and the canal will furnish all the labor and the engineering and all those things. The next one is Green River Rock Springs Raw Water Reservoir, Sweetwater County, $7,382,000, 50% grant, and they're building the reservoir right there by the Green River. They'll take the water out of the Green River, put it in this reservoir, and then it'll settle out, and it'll save them a lot of money on their treating plant. The next one's Wright Water Supply, Campbell County, $1,072,000, 67% grant. It's for pipelines, and they'll come up with the rest of the money. The next one is up in Park County, Willwood Dam Rehab, Park County, $1,410,000, 67% grant, 33% loan, 4% interest, 30 years. And we're putting in, there's 3 sluice gates in their dam, and it's all silted in. They just barely have one gate that'll work, so we're going to dredge the sand and the fill out and put them in two new gates, and then they'll put a buffer around there, and then they'll have to figure out how they're going to flush that reservoir, because they only let so much silt down in the into the Shoshone River, because the game and fish have a lot of fishery in there. So, but they said they'll make it work. So the total for all of them and count one is $6,172,170, and account two is $3,518,500. If you have any questions, I'll bring out the blue book.
Any questions on that?
No questions, okay.
If not, we'll move on to the Standing Committee
we'll move
Amendment.
On to the Standing Committee Amendment, and I'll yield that to Senator Bebout to explain the amendment.
This Standing Committee Amendment has been read in and moved. Senator Bebout.
The Standing Committee Amendment been moved? I believe it has it not?
Yes, it has.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And members of the Senate, I want to talk a little bit about a situation that exists in Fremont County. And the first thing I want to do is just clarify one of the issues that a lot of people have concerns about. The town of Pavilion does not have a problem. The town of Pavilion has good water, and a lot of people in that community are a little upset that they are branded. So I want everybody in this body and those that are listening out there to understand this is not about the town of Pavilion. This is about an area east of the town of Pavilion. And, Mr. Chairman, what this deals with is an issue that many residents out in there, and the numbers between 15 and 30, have existing water wells, and these water wells have some problems with these water. And this has been an ongoing issue that's, I think it's been going for 3 years now. The landowners out there requested and had a lot of support and information gathering from the state of Wyoming through the Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality and through the Wyoming Oil and Gas Commission. More recently, a lot of you probably read and heard about the EPA, who was actively working with our state people on this particular issue, decided to go out there and do something more or less on their own. And as far as I know, we were not notified of it. So much for the spirit of cooperation. But they, in fact, did conduct and drill two monitoring wells. And out of those wells, they drew some conclusions that a lot of people say are suspect. And what's happened, Mr. Chairman, overnight, that particular release from the EPA relative to hydraulic fracturing potentially causing problems for these water wells went out to 13 countries the next day, I think 400 newspapers, and overnight it was a national issue. And in fact, there was a New York Times article that talked about the reservation in Fremont County and Hot Springs County that mentioned it. It's just an issue that has exploded. And, Mr. Chairman, what this proposed amendment does, and it's under Water Development Account 1, New Projects, subsection O on page, it's after line 41 on page 10. It's not getting into the issue of trying to figure out what has caused the particular issue with the water and the water not being potable. I will share with you that there has been, and I hate to use the term bad water, but water that didn't rise to the standards that people felt comfortable consuming it out in this area for many, many, many years. What we don't know is if this water now that we're talking about that is contaminated and there are contaminants in it, what really caused it. This particular amendment does not get into that issue. I'm not sure, Mr. Chairman, if that will ever be resolved to the satisfaction of all parties concerned. All kinds of different entities are involved for different reasons and pointing fingers, and there's hidden agendas, there's hidden politics. But what we're trying to do here, Mr. Chairman, is try to solve the problem. And the problem is there are people out there that have water that's not potable. And, Mr. Chairman, I'll just go through this particular amendment and clarify and say what it does. The project sponsor would be the Wyoming Water Development Commission. The project purpose is rural domestic water supply. The description says design and construction of cistern systems, a water loading station, and the appurtenances necessary to make the project function in the manner intended. And, Mr. Chairman, last year and during the last session, the general session we had, under the Water Development Commission, we authorized a study to be conducted by an engineer to go out there and look at the water situation and come back with recommendations to the citizens out there at different ways they might go. And we looked at tying into the pavilion water system, running underground water lines to each of the individual homes. What happens, Mr. Chairman, obviously if these are farms, there's quite a bit of distance between. It's not a high-density area. You have 160-acre, 200-acre, 300-acre farms, and the cost to, in fact, put in an underground installation, water lines to each individual home, was very cost-prohibitive. The number that I remember that each individual landowner, if they tied into that system, would have to pay was $800 per month. And that's just not affordable. And so, Mr. Chairman, we put in the cistern system as a way which is much, much less expensive and offers these people an opportunity to get some good water. The project cost is $750,000. Mr. Chairman, that's an estimate. It's an estimate that we worked with the Wyoming Water Development Commission on in the governor's office. And this appropriation under line 18, there's appropriated from Wyoming Water Development Account 1 to the commission the $750,000, and it shall revert if not utilized by July 1 of 2017. Mr. Chairman, the important thing about this, and I want to share with the Senate, is starting on line 25, special conditions. And the commission, in coordination with the governor's office, Select Water Committee, Department of Environmental Quality, and the Wyoming Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, shall develop project operating criteria to include but not limited to the following. The project area, there's a map on your desk that shows the area where the gas field is. You can see on the map it shows the wells that have received some contamination, and you can get an idea of the size of it, but how many participate and how many don't. It also says that the eligibility of residents, some of the people in that area, for whatever reason, have good water. So how do we establish who's eligible? And then the one thing we don't want to do under the utilization of water sources, which do not impact existing uses, we don't want to go out there, and if we tie into the town of Pavilion's water system, we don't want to impact their water system. It's working. It's in good shape. So we don't want to do that. The critical thing, too, Mr. Chairman, is that there are other parties that are willing to participate in this. Certainly you could argue that some of the homeowners out there should have some skin in the game. That's up for discussion. Certainly the operator of the oil and gas well down in that area should be involved, and that's open for discussion. Mr. Chairman, going on line 36, the commission is authorized to enter into the project agreement with an entity eligible to be a project sponsor. We need to have someone that's willing to take this on. It could be a water district. I will tell you that if, in order to form a water district, it's a process that involves people in the area being willing to step up and be in the water district. That remains to be seen whether or not they will be in the water district. Certainly the town of Pavilion could be asked to participate and be that sponsoring entity. I've spoken with the mayor out there. At least there's some interest there. And then going on to line 40, Mr. Chairman, I think this is very important. This project and the financing plan address a unique situation and shall not be considered by the commission as a precedent for any future project unless expressly approved by the governor and the legislature. So, Mr. Chairman, in wrapping it up, I'll be glad to answer any questions, of course, but what we're looking at doing is we're not going to get into the issue of trying to figure out what caused the problem. We recognize there is a problem. It's something that we should deal with. It's not unlike this body to deal with these kind of situations before. We're going to try to solve the long-term problem, which is getting good water for these people. I would ask for your favorable consideration.
Any discussion on the amendments? Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I do have some question about this. The question is going to be how bad really is this water? What can you use it for where it is contaminated? And, Mr. Chairman, I'll bring you some personal background. We don't have potable water at our ranch. It has too much sulfate in it. I can recommend it to you if you need a good laxative. It has certain effects. And I've been hauling my drinking water since 1974. It's a nuisance. It's not, costs a little bit to haul it. I had to go buy some 5-gallon jugs, and they last a long time. And the well water we've got is good enough quality for other purposes. You can wash dishes, you can wash clothes, you can use it for all those kind of purposes, but I do not recommend drinking it. And hauling water is not that uncommon, Mr. Chairman, in our rural areas because frequently there are natural contaminants in it. And the question in my mind is, so special, that we ought to spend $750,000, and I'm not clear how many people are involved in this, of state money, when maybe there's a simpler remedy, and let the people do as I do and haul their water, which I presume is what they've been doing now. So my question is this, how bad is the water? What else can you use it for other purposes other than drinking? And second, does it appear that if the contamination was because of oil and gas drilling, and that's one of our primary industries, and we have some obligation to take care of people that get harmed by that industry, that's one thing. If it's just the natural conditions that are there anyhow, that's a risk you run in the country. And a number of us ran that risk with our eyes open and wind up hauling our drinking water. So that's my set of questions.
Senator Bebaugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And my tall friend from Natrona County brings up some very good points, and I'll try to answer all of them. And the first one is, how bad is the water, and is it high in sulfates? And the question is, it does have some natural contaminants. That certainly is the case out there. And the second question is it utilized strictly for use within the home for domestic use, or can it be used for livestock use? As I understand it, it's almost a well-by-well basis, where some of the wells have been looked at by the EPA and said you should not consume it because of the contaminants in it, but yet some of the water could be used for livestock watering. And this relates to the Safe Water Drinking Act and some of the levels, and I can get you the specifics about the different wells that have that condition. They do not, and they have said you shall not drink that water. So, yes, they are hauling or not drinking the water, utilizing, making other arrangements. We realize and we believe there are 16 wells that have some kind of contamination, but there are another 16 that may be in question. The real crux of it is a contamination by oil and gas. Well, that's the whole point. To be able to determine that and find out if that is a cause is going to take a long time, because this is a known hydrocarbon-bearing area. And there's natural gas at 300 feet, there's natural gas at 600 feet, and obviously there's natural gas at the producing formation level, which is from 3,000 to 6,000 feet. So it's naturally occurring in that particular area. So is it oil and gas drilling that caused the problem, or is it natural? And that's where the whole debate is. The whole debate is between pointing the finger at the oil and gas operator, is that the problem, or is it naturally occurring hydrocarbons that occur in these hydrocarbon-bearing formations? And that's the issue. So that's why it's unusual, why it's unique. And the other thing, too, Mr. Chairman, is it's just laid the level of hydraulic fracturing debate to a high level because of the politics of it. And a lot of people would love to see hydraulic fracturing be the one that caused this, if it could ever be proved. I don't think it is the cause, but that certainly is a huge issue. And if you eliminate hydraulic fracturing to the country, which a lot of people like to see happen, we all know the significance of that. I hope I've answered your question.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, that really didn't answer the question. I hadn't thought yet. The livestock is an issue. The question is the water good enough for domestic purposes other than drinking? Now, washing, in particular, washing clothes, washing yourself, washing dishes. In the case I'm familiar with, in my case, yeah, it's perfectly good for that. You just can't drink it. If that's the circumstance, I think that this expenditure is out of line, and I don't see why they can't do as many people do in our rural areas and haul their drinking water.
Senator Geis.
Mr. Chairman, all we can say is it's left up to the EPA to decide which ones are used for human consumption or which ones can't. So we figured out we would install the system cisterns and get this thing behind us, and then from then on they'll pay to have their water hauled and put in this cistern and take care of it. But it's strictly up to the EPA to see which ones are and which ones aren't.
Senator Bebaugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The only thing I would add to that, and therein lies the problem, because you have four different opinions on each well. But what I will try to do is, as I understand it, there are certain conditions and certain wells that you cannot drink the water, but you can use it for other domestic use. There are other wells that may not be able to do that. I would hope that you would support this amendment, and I will get specific well-by-well data for you and present it to you tomorrow to try to more answer the entire question.
Senator Hicks.
Chairman, this question was specifically asked of the Director Cora within our committee meeting. And my recollection of his response was, right now, at least the wells that they've tested, the majority of those meet state standards, but there is some potential contaminants that are bumping up against that regulatory limit within the safe drinking water standards. Other uses could be used for anything but drinking water. Specifically asked him in stock water, there'd be nothing to prevent that. It's primarily just drinking, bathing, showering, and these other arenas, as I understood Mr. Cora, as long as it wasn't human consumption, would meet state standards.
Okay. This is, we're going to be voting on the amendment. The question's been called on the amendment. All those in favor of Senator Geis's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment of the Whole Number 1 to Senate File 47, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. Amendment has passed. The motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 47 has passed. Next bill for our consideration. Oh. That's right. Thank you. Sorry. All those in favor of Senator Geis's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise, direction of Senate File 47, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. It has passed. Senate File 47 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Now, the next bill for our consideration is Senate File 52. Will the reading clerk please read the bill?
Senate File 52, sponsored by Senator Ruffus. Dyslexia Screening and Response, an Active Reading Assessment and Intervention. It was referred to Committee Number 4, Education. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Barnard, Cole, Jennings, Landon, Rothfuss, Senator Cole, Chairman.
Senator Rothfuss.
No. Over to Senator.
Oh, Senator... Senator Coe, sorry.
Chairman, I'd move when the Committee of the Whole rise and report to do so with a do-pass recommendation on Senate File 52 and defer to Senator Ruffus.
Senator Ruffus, then.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sorry for that confusion. Mr. Chairman, this is a relatively simple and straightforward bill, but hopefully it will have a significant impact for our educational community. Mr. Chairman, this is a bill that will address the assessment and early intervention for dyslexia and other reading difficulties. If you look at page 2 of the bill, there's a few provisions that are added to the current reading assessment and intervention statutes, the first of which can be seen in lines 10 through 11, which basically indicates that the school district will extend their reading and screening program to include attempts to identify dyslexia and other reading difficulties as early as possible in kindergarten through grade 3. It goes on in lines 18 through 22 to indicate that in addition to a universal screening instrument, the Department of Education shall identify standardized assessment instruments utilized to identify dyslexia and other reading difficulties. So there's some responsibility for the Department of Education to help facilitate this for the school districts. On to page 3, Mr. Chairman, is a little bit of a discussion on what will happen in terms of remediation. It begins on line 1, and indicate that that remediative program for interventions, the program shall be multi-tiered and shall include various interventions to encourage remediation of any reading difficulty as early as possible. Now, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to discuss that point a little bit. There's a couple of models that are used in the state and throughout the country. One of the models for intervention with regard to remediation on learning problems is what's called a severe discrepancy model. The severe discrepancy model basically requires that a child falls well behind, perhaps up to 2 grades behind, before they are then eligible to be helped through the program. So basically what you have to do is you have to let a child fail, and then you struggle to try and catch that child back up. Now, there's an alternative strategy which is a little bit more difficult, perhaps, because it requires an active intervention, and it's a strategy called response to intervention. whereby you basically identify as early as possible a difficulty with a child's reading abilities or perhaps dyslexia but other reading difficulties. And based on that child's need, you try to teach that child to stay at grade level, to stay in their classes, to not have to go over to the special education, but instead try to keep up. In other words, you try to respond as quickly as possible, intervene as quickly as possible, and the theory is obviously that that's the best for everybody. It's the best for the schools, best for the teachers, and obviously best for the students. This piece of legislation, while not forbidding the first approach of the severe discrepancy model, because we wanted to make sure that we were consistent with other legislation that might affect special education, makes it very difficult to do anything but that second choice of response to intervention, and that's the obvious intent here. You'd better have a good reason to let a child fall well behind before helping them to learn to read and to catch back up. What this bill does, basically, is to require some reporting. We want to make sure that this is working. If it's not working, we want to know why, and we want to be able to address that. So on page 3, it indicates that if there's a reporting requirement where the reporting shall also include the aggregate number of students identified by the screening tools as having dyslexia or other reading difficulties in each district by grade. That way we can get a sense of what's going on and whether this program's working. And then finally on page 4 is an indication that the state superintendent shall promulgate rules and regulations as necessary to administer the reading assessment and intervention program pursuant to this statute. And finally in lines 9 through 17 on page 4 is a further reporting requirement requiring that the state superintendent shall indicate to the Joint Education Interim Committee no later than August 1st, 2012, about the actions taken with regard to that universal screening instrument. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate a favorable consideration on this bill. I think it's an excellent step towards identifying and remediating some of the early reading difficulties we have. We've had a lot of discussion in the past in our committee and on this floor about the fact that we need to teach kids to learn to read so that they can read to learn. And this is obviously trying to address that K through 3 early reading problems that we face in some of our school districts. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be open for any discussion or questions on the bill. Thank you.
Any discussion? Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I do rise to say I support this bill. I think this is a further creative attempt at dealing with the problems here. It does amend a bill we passed in 2001 that, frankly, was a piece of my legislation that was based on a successful program in an Arkansas school district. And I want to warn the proponents one thing they need to watch out for and think if you can find a remedy. With the original bill, many of the school districts in this state just flat ignored it. The requirement in there, it's trying to deal with the problem that too many of our kids are not learning how to read in the early grades. And, Mr. Chairman, if a kid doesn't learn how to read in the early grades, they'll be in trouble for the rest of their academic career and probably the rest of their life. And the education establishment in this state has resisted it, has in many cases failed to implement what we required. And it's one of the reasons we are not getting the performance out of our school districts, our school systems, that we ought to be getting given the amount of money we're spending. And what I urge the proponents of this bill to think about is what are we going to do with those districts that ignore the state law in this area, do not follow through, will not implement your program? Because we need to have a remedy, because it is one of the major failings of a number of school districts in this state.
Any further discussion on the bill? Question being called. Oh, sorry. Senator Nutting, let me see you.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to ask for a couple points of clarification. In this program, is it a one lifetime test, or is this a screening exam, or is this a screening exam that would be repeated in each grade level for the same students? And how long does this screening test require?
Senator Hines, did I find you here?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, another question or two. As I read the bill, it calls for implementing, and I assume that in the following year. And then in the note on the last page, it talks about the impact that would be. They said there would be an impact to Department of Education. I would say they forgot to list the local school districts. And I don't know very little about these type programs, but it would appear to me that perhaps there definitely would be a cost. And what I'm wondering if there would need to be more staff, qualified staff added, and if so, you could address those issues.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just up on that point, I just wanted to make sure that I had heard correctly today. What we've got is a is a good idea that we want to that the bill sponsors would like to impose upon and on local school districts. However, there's no penalty if they don't. They've apparently been asked to do something like this in the past and haven't. And then, the other thing I think is just to follow up on what the good senator from Campbell County was talking about as well. When we do this, in the back end, the administrative in the fiscal note says there's an impact, but they don't know what it is. Ultimately, when we do these things, it seems to me we're just backdooring those into the formula. I mean, these things are going to, it's going to increase cost to schools. We've got, the schools have the ability, we have to fund the schools at that cost, and so ultimately we're backdooring this into the cost, increasing the cost of education as well, and we're just backdooring it, we don't know what the number is now. I'm just wondering how we go about this, because we're really good at telling local, governments what to do, and that here's a great idea. We don't fund it so that they have the money to do it. There's no penalty if they don't, but nevertheless, we're going to make it a law anyway. And, I'm just trying to figure out how this all works.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, the first attempt on this, the reading assessment program, we funded it and they still didn't do it. They took the money and spent it, but they still didn't do it, many of them. I think the lack of funding here is probably an assessment that we have funded the schools so well that they can afford to do what this calls for, which I don't think is overly expensive. And curing the reading problems that kids have in these early grades is fundamental to everything that the school districts are doing. That's their basic mission, and we have very well funded the basic mission.
Senator Barnard.
Mr. Chairman, in regard to the cost that this will do, most of these tests can be administered by the school nurse. I think every school has a school nurse. Probably the amount of tests for dyslexia, in my estimation, would probably be maybe a 1 or 2 minute test. Probably they could get the information from that and would be a minimal cost once that was done. There's also a school psychologist that can give these tests. And I also would like to remind you here on page 2, line 11, it talked about reading difficulties. Reading difficulties are probably twice to three times more common than dyslexia is. And so this is a great bill because it's going to try to pick up these reading difficulties and the dyslexia both. I think these tests are within the purview of the school nurses, and I think they could be done quickly. If you have a child that's not progressing, not doing well in reading, somebody's desk can pick up these children really, really easily and really quickly. So I would hope that we can pass this, and I don't think it's going to cost that much.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me run through some responses to some of the excellent questions that were raised by my colleagues. Addressing the concern of the taller gentleman from Natrona County, or tall est, I should say, regarding the fact that this has been tried before to some degree and wasn't necessarily implemented. That was one of the reasons why we're looking for this reporting requirement. I would like for this to be done and performed correctly without having to have some onerous punishment in place. That said, if we don't see it being done, we certainly have the ability to come back and revisit this and do more of a thou shalt approach where we tie it to something. You can hearken back to previous legislation we did here regarding 16-to-1 ratio where it wasn't implemented and then we came back and strengthened it. So we certainly have the tools and the means to strengthen it if necessary. But I'd prefer to take the approach where we clarify what we would like to see done, which it's not necessarily spelled out well enough based on some of my conversations with folks that have been in special education over the years, that having the ambiguity between which model you can use allows enough wiggle room. This tries to force it in the correct direction. So hopefully that'll be taken care of, but it's certainly a concern that we share, or that I share, and therefore the reporting requirement to see if it's actually being implemented over the next couple of years. With regard to the good Senate woman from Laramie County here who asked about the specifics of the testing. Well, this is something that's going to be carried out through rules and regulations, and theoretically they'll be developing these themselves. It'll be in consultation, obviously, with the Superintendent of Public Instruction. But the reality is there are some tests out there. There are various types of tests. There are early indicator tests, and I would have an expectation that it would be kind of a continuous process where you'd be looking for signs over time. It doesn't have to be an exhaustive test, but what you would probably want is a pre-screening type concept that then can be followed up with more extensive testing if there's an indication. For example, we do kindergarten readiness screening at this point in time. You could take and add a 1 or 2 minute component, as the good senator from the western part of the state indicated, and probably have a lot of information very quickly about who seems to be at risk and needs further testing versus who is carrying along nicely. Let's see. Regarding the cost and the impact on the Department of Education and the fiscal note, we had additional testimony in committee that indicated that the Department of Education was willing to basically say there wouldn't necessarily be any additional administrative requirements of a half-time FTE or anything else along those lines, and they were willing to accept the fact that they could take that on board. That said, this is obviously something that will have to be worked into the schedule of districts so that they're taking care of it and coordinating. But again, I don't think this is an onerous cost or an onerous responsibility. These are the kinds of things that we want the schools to do. I think it's probably obvious to everyone that we need to be identifying reading disabilities and reading problems, dyslexia, difficulties, anything else. And if we're not doing that, we're probably wasting a lot of money through special education programs that wouldn't necessarily have been required if you had identified early. So while we can't make a strong estimate of whether money would be saved, I would expect that we would be reducing the special education budget if we don't require people to fall 2 years behind before we help them. If we can keep people out of the special education program because we keep them in the classroom and at grade level, that's a significant cost savings. So there's some trade-offs and there's some balance, and I can't make any assurances on that. But compared to the overall cost and responsibilities of our education system, I think this relatively small tweak could provide significant reward. Let's see. Regarding the penalties, I addressed that in a previous consideration. I don't think we need to put penalties in place right now, Mr. Chairman, but if that is necessary because people aren't following through, we can look to that in the future. And I believe that's where I'll stop right now, but I'd be happy to answer any additional questions, Mr. Chairman, if others come up.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you. I appreciate those explanations. Very good. But I guess the thing that struck me is, as I was listening, you know, at least in my school district, it seems like we've got resource reading teachers all over the place. And, I mean, even I know that you need to catch reading early, and that if you don't, and if I know that, I can't believe that the teachers don't know that. So I guess my question is, I'm still struggling why the, I don't know anybody that has any even tangential association with education that doesn't understand the need for catching this reading early. I know we've got reading resource teachers and specialists throughout the system that I thought this is what they were doing, and now I'm distressed to learn that we're not doing that at all. And so what are our resource teachers doing and our reading resource doing if they're not catching this and helping students read at grade level? I thought that's what they were all doing in the first place.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There are tests for this, but it's... it kind of sneaks up. You could have a student that has a mild case. And if you can imagine that every time you looked at a phone number, that the last four digits traded places some of the time. And so then you should have been tested. But what you look at is a student that will continually fall behind a little bit at a time. And then all of a sudden, he's fallen behind enough that it's created a situation where everybody starts looking at it. But this can get you just a little bit here and a little bit there. And some people say all of us have a little bit of this. But the real problem is, I mean, the real solution is that there are some very easy tests for it now. And they're not being brought forward, and they're not being implemented. And the good senator from, and he hasn't been called this yet this year, from the ivory towers, makes a good point that you could do an easy test. You can put some numbers or some words and have the kids repeat them or write them back down. It's not that hard to do it. And so you put it in there. A lot of teachers, a lot of the reading specialists haven't been trained in this, and it's something that we need to get on the cutting edge of, push out there a little bit, because every day that a student can't read is the same as he was truant. And every day, and we know from our studies that truant kids, every day they miss, they fall farther and farther behind, and then sooner or later, you can predict that they're not going to graduate. And when you have a child with this problem, and he falls a day behind here and a day behind there, that's the same as not being in school. And it's even more frustrating for the child because he's there trying, and he just sees everything backwards. This is a good bill, and I think we should just pass it.
President Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll try to be brief. My experience in having taught second grade for 12 years, and second grade is that grade of which you capture some of these children that have these reading problems. But first of all, the target here is third grade reading. That's the target, and that's the one that we're going to talk about in the assessment process. So what is it going to take to get these children up and to speed to third grade reading? Now, if you have a child that's coming in at kindergarten that's behind in a race, it's really not a very long race. It's a sprint from kindergarten to third grade, and they start the race behind. They're not going to be there. Well, you need to ask yourself, as you look into your correctional institutions, educational remediation, boys and girls clubs, and some of these places where we find children are having difficulty, how many of them might have fallen into this category had it been identified at an early age, and they could have been brought up to the starting line in this sprint that they're making to third grade that would have had a much different outcome? Now, you'll hear me talk a lot about it, and in regard to early literacy. And I'm not going to shut up about it, because that's what's missing in this whole multi-million dollar expenditure we're making. We started building from top down, and I was part of it. We started with Hathaway and we invested all the amount of money we've invested in K through 12. Missing part, K to 3, in order to get these kids on a launching platform to get started in K to 3, we need to know about these things. This is one thing. Dyslexia is certainly one thing. Another thing may be autism, another thing. But I will tell you that having taught, and you've seen it in your own children, you've seen it in your own grandchildren, there are some things that children automatically do in terms of reversal. They'll reverse their E's, and they'll start spelling their name, Jim, and they'll have the J reversed. That's normal and natural in some children, but it takes experts with a simple test that's been described to you to just separate out what's truly a problem, what's natural, identify it early, correct it, and get these children started on a path where they're going to achieve. Third grade is a target. We talk about no consequences in here. The consequences are for the child winding up somewhere outside, off the road, in the bar ditch in regard to the system. Art Wolnick, a member of the Federal Reserve System in Minneapolis, did studies in regard to investments in children at an early age. From $7 to $14 to one returned on investing in children at this age. I support the bill.
Okay. Question on the bill. All those in favor of Senators Coe's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with the favorable recommendation of Senate File 52, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. That's good. The Senate File 52 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 85. Will the reading clerk please read the bill?
Senate File 85, sponsored by the Minerals Committee, General Permits, an act relating to administrative procedure. It was referred to Committee Number 9, Business Minerals, Business and Economic Development. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Bebout, Cole, Cooper, Jennings, and Rothfuss. Senator Bebout, Chairman.
Senator Bebout. You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Bebout?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that the Committee of the Whole rise report to do so with a favorable recommendation. Senate File 85 do pass. There is not a standing committee amendment, and I yield to the floor sponsor, Senator Jennings.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, one day there was a DEQ. And DEQ worked hard to try to make sure that we could process permits for things that they wanted to do. And then DEQ started to group things together. And they, watersheds, stormwater, stuff like this. And they came up with a, what they called a general permit. And the general permit allowed them to put things that were alike together and issue a general permit for a certain area or a certain discharge and then have somebody just send you a notice when they wanted to add to it. So if you had an area In the case that brought this up was coal bed methane. So they issued a broad general permit that said if you had a discharge on coal bed methane, that if it wasn't any different from the one over here or the one over there, and the water was pretty close to the same, that you could have a general permit and send a notice in to DEQ when you needed another one. Then there was a lawyer. Maybe he should be a judge. But he was a lawyer, and he said no. And they went to court, and the court said the lawyer must know what he's talking about, and agreed, the judge agreed with the lawyer, and then said that, no, you can't have a general permit, that because under the Wyoming Administrative Procedure Act, it's a rule, it's not a permit, and therefore you have to do a whole bunch more stuff to have this permit. And you can't do a general permit anymore. So DEQ went back and looked after the this decision in the court and decided that there are six exclusions in all of this DEQ stuff that you can have a general permit. And they wondered if the judge really understood rules and permits. So rather than arguing, they came to us and they said, would you give us a section in the statute that gives us an exception so we can do general permits. And DEQ told us that if we don't do this, that you're going to need to do a general permit and each occurrence inside the general permit, that you'll have to go through the Environmental Quality Council, then review by LSO, Management Council, and ultimately signed by the governor. He said you also might have to look at the thousands of authorizations of stormwater and wastewater general permits that are in doubt. So it's not just these coal bed wells out there, now it's other things. Then you have the cost that you would have to. So if you wanted to do a stormwater permit now under this without a general permit, every single little case that you wanted to send in the notice on the general permit, now you would have to come back and you'd have to go through the whole procedure. But then the Environmental Quality Council would be the one issuing the permit. But aren't they the ones that review the permit? So you wouldn't have a way to come back and argue in favor or against the permit in that kind of a case. A bad thing coming down the rule is the new pesticide rules from EPA. And it would result in hundreds of applications needing individual permits. Again, you'd have to go through all this stuff and big public hearings. But our ag guys, when they go out and they say, well, here's a pesticide that we're going to use, and this is the bugs or whatever it kills,
And you say, well, okay, as long as you fit into this general permit and you send us the notice of you're going to use it, then we would want to do it. But no, because of the lawyer and the judge, it has to go through all of this rigmarole in each one of these levels for each occurrence of using the pesticide. There's all kinds of other idea or incidents. If you have a gravel mixer batch plant out, every time you'd have to move it, you'd have to go back. So what the DEQ asked us to do, and it's fairly simple, is to go into the statute and add, and you can see this on page 2, line 13 of the bill, under general permit. They want an exception so they can come in and do general permits. It says general permit means a permit issued by the Department of Environmental Quality which authorizes a category or categories of discharges and emissions. And then you go a little further, and they want to add in that general permits shall be issued solely in accordance with the procedures set forth by regulations adopted by the council, and procedures for the issuance of general permits shall include public notice and an opportunity for comment. So it doesn't take anything away from the public, but it helps streamline this. And if you want DEQ to be out there processing little single permits that all look the same in the count of hundreds or thousands, then we should kill this. If you want to streamline it to where they can group things together, then we need to give them the ability for the general permit. And I would ask for your favorable consideration on this good little bill.
Discussion on the bill. Senator Schiffer.
You know, Mr. Chairman, I'm confused. My colleague is talking about, Administrative Procedures Act and some council, I don't know. I've looked up the statute, subparagraph A. It says the director will issue the permit, and he's got 60 days to do it. This is a problem. This is a solution looking for a problem. And I don't know where my colleague gets all the rest of this. And I'm in the cattle business. So you know what I deal with. And I don't know. But what this is an attempt to make sure that if you're impacted, not CBM was the one that was brought up. If you're an operation impacted by one of these discharge permits, it's okay. Director issues the permit, he's got 60 days to do it. But if you're the one impacted, if it's on your place, your ranch, your livelihood, you can say, wait a minute, this is going to impact me. And all you do is send an email to the director. You know he's got 60 days. At the end of 60 days, he's going to issue that. So you're under the gun. What they're trying to do is circumvent this. Now, if what you want to do is take the landowner, the property owner, the surface owner, out of the equation, vote for this bill. That's what my colleague is doing. He's saying, you folks are not in this process. You're excluded because we got a general permit for the Powder River Basin, all the way from hell to breakfast. That's what this bill does. It has nothing to do with the council. The director issues the permit, and he's got 60 days to do it. But if you're a property owner, you have the right to say, Mr. Director, I got a question about this. But if you want to exclude, vote for this bill. Sure. But that's what it does. It excludes the surface owner.
Senator Bebop.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm listening to what my colleague from Johnson County is talking about, and let's keep an eye on what we're really trying to do here, members of the Senate. Excuse me. Right now, if you have a general permit based on this decision that's been authorized by or laid down by a district court, which will probably be approved, all general permits will be treated with and have to go through the rulemaking process.
all general permits. So we talked about the litany of 7,000 permits out there now that have been issued under the general permits may have to be entirely gone through one by one to go through the rulemaking process. Or if you go to future permits, every general permit will have to go through the entire rulemaking process. Now, the one that makes the rulemaking process is the Environmental Quality Council. So how do you appeal it? It takes away that provision. And if you look at the law and what this change provides, is that for general permits shall go through the rulemaking process, just like under the Administrative Procedures Act. That's set up. That will be followed. That will be done. You will have ample time for public comment. They'll be promulgated. They'll go to the Management Council. They'll go to everybody that needs to approve them, and they will become a rule that's implemented by the state. Now, under that rule, if there's a specific general permit, my colleague's right, that the DEQ will issue that permit. Now, if you look at the bill on page 2, under line on D, starting with line 1, they shall be issued solely in accordance with the procedure set forth by regulation adopted by the council. So we're going to tell them what they have to do under the rulemaking procedure, and that they shall include public notice and an opportunity for comment, so they can be appealed to the Environmental Quality Council. It's a complicated issue because of the watershed permits that happened in the CBM area, and that's what brought this whole thing. And we try to look at ways to separate the two with a general permit. We're not able to do that. If my colleague has a way that we can do that and take care of your concerns, I'm willing to listen to that. But the bigger issue is the entire general permitting process and what this does to the whole system of what the DEQ has been operating under for many, many years. And we're trying to just alleviate a problem. If the Supreme Court, that should say, probably will, and support the district court, we're right back here. What do we do as a body after the Supreme Court's made a decision? We'll have the same debate. And so I would submit to you, let's deal with the problem now. If we vote this bill down, we're going to have that same issue. It's going to be out there. It's going to be a lot of burden to a lot of people that have no reason to be burdened by this. If there's an issue relative to your issue, my colleague from Johnson County, I'm willing to sure look at that and see how you deal with the watershed areas individually and how that might work.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, what my colleague from Fremont County said is absolutely true. If you vote for this bill, you will create a general permit. If you don't, if you say no to this, the director issues permits. He's got 60 days to do it. If you're an impacted surface owner, you can say, Mr. Director, you just flooded my basement, or whatever it did. But what they're trying to do is say, if you're the surface owner, you're out. Name me most ranchers do not have the money, nor the time, nor can they hire a lawyer, because there's no damages, there's no lawyer's fees, to appeal one of these things to the EQC and then the district court. That's a fact. That is just a flat fact. They can't afford to fight it. Can my colleagues at mineral companies fight it? You bet. They got lawyers on staff. That's why I say what you're doing is kicking out the surface owner. If they go to a regular permit, it comes down in 60 days in the statute. DEQ can't hold it up. The law says you will issue it in 60 days. That's a pretty reasonable time. That's a pretty, you know, particularly given the state of CBM and most of these other projects, in terms of the permits they have to get from the federal government, from all these other folks and the zoning laws and all the things they have to put up with, which I sympathize. But what they've done here is saying we're going to short-circuit it, what is now a statutorily defined window of 60 days. We'll short-circuit that. You may not get your permit from the BLM, because BLM can hold them as long as they want to. You might not get your permit from the Forest Service or whoever else. What they're saying to the citizens of the state, the private landowners, you're out. We're going to create a general permit, and you're out. I'll give you an example. If you want to know how big these things can be, South Fork of Powder River starts over southwest of Casper and runs all the way to the Montana line, the northern quarter of the state. What these folks are telling you is issue one permit that a rancher can't afford to appeal for that drainage. Lock, stock, and barrel. My neighbors in Natrona County, my neighbors over in Crook and Weston County are lumped in with me under a general permit. And we own the land, but unless we can go hire a lawyer and appeal it, we're out. Grin and bear it. That's what this does. You're creating a general permit, and it's totally unnecessary. Totally unnecessary. And the effect of it, when you can go across five different counties, somewhere around 280 miles to the Montana line to cover Powder River, careful what you ask for, folks. Be very careful what you ask for. Vote this sucker down.
Senator Bebout.
Yeah.
Member of the Senate, if you vote this down, what you're going to do to everybody that would apply and be under general permit will have to go the complete rulemaking procedure. And let me give you some examples. If you have a batch plant and you have a 1 or 2 acre spread that you do when you move your batch plant, you have to have a stormwater permit. That stormwater permit will require you to go through the entire rulemaking procedure, everything. If you happen to have a livestock operating facility where you have a feedlot and you need to have some kind of a stormwater permit there, you're going to have to go through the entire rulemaking procedure. So I would submit to you that when you look at this, you have so many individuals in our state that if you don't have a general permit, look at the burden you will place on them. Look at the burden you're going to place on ag with pesticides. There's an issue out there, and we're coming down with some federal EPA regulations that you're going to have to apply pesticides. Now, you may be an applicator, or you may be an individual rancher or farmer, but if you do that and you have to have a permit, are you going to have to go through the entire rulemaking procedure? The Department of Environment and Quality tells us that you will have to. So that's who is affected by this. Now, my colleague from Johnson County is right. If you have a general permit for the watershed area and the DEQ chooses to have a big area, he's correct. But I would submit to you that there are so many people that are affected by this, and the other side, they should give this careful consideration. I would not kill this bill today. If there's a way to work out 280 miles of area, then let's talk about it. That's certainly a good, valid reason to have some concerns. But look at the impacts to all the other people if we don't do this.
Senator Ross.
Mr. Chairman, and a question, because I'm not certain, I don't practice law in this area, I have no idea what's going on here. True story. But it appears to me that what we've done is you've gone into the permit section of the law, particularly with regards to paragraph D. And I'm wondering, does this then open up general permits for air quality and everything else? Maybe we already do that now. I don't know. But I'm wondering, it seems that we may be opening up more than just dealing with this particular issue of CBM, but you may be opening it up for air quality and whatever else also in a general permit situation. I'm not certain. That's why I'm asking the question.
Go to Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm kind of wondering here. I know if as a single rancher, you might not have enough money to mount a legal defense or some kind of communication with DEQ, but if it was a general permit, I'm wondering what would prohibit like a class action methodology where if you had 200 ranchers that were affected by a general permit, that they couldn't all get together, hire one attorney, and represent them all. I'm wondering why that couldn't happen and actually would be a benefit to the process.
Senator Driscoll.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I think
with what we've heard, and I tend to be with a good senator from the South, I'm pretty severely confused. And what I've seen on the overall end of it is potentially private property owners can take a huge hit at the expense of industry. And I think back to what the other good senator from the South said, I don't want to be part of a class action suit. I want to be able to have private property rights stand on their own. And it appears to me this might be really a great topic for an interim study to take a look at how we can really do this so that everybody can come out good, industry and private as well. Thank you.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, somebody that deals with a lot of permit issues, federal and state, ranging from water quality to storage. In general, I would tell you this whole debate revolves around the necessity of the state. The general permits overall tend to be a good thing. But what we're debating here is the devils in the details. Getting back to what the good senator from Johnson County said, what you need to build into a general permit is those protections and those permit conditions that address those issues. And you can do that through the Administrative Procedures Act, but you need to be upfront and forward thinking as to what those restrictions is. In other words, it may require landowner notification before an action can take place under a general permit. It can restrict it to a first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth order HUC code as far as the hydrology is the area that you can do this. So this issue, this discussion is both correct, but I would tell you they're too broad and we're not being surgical here. But you have to understand under those general permits come general conditions to comply with the permit. Where we need to be very careful is on those general conditions to address what we're trying to do here. The general permits are a good thing over here. So the devil's in the details, I'm going to tell you when it comes to these general permits. Most of the time they're a good thing if the conditions that are applied to the permit are well thought out and well implemented. And I don't know that this body can answer that question. And that's why you have the Administrative Procedures Act to go through and flesh these out, to have these debates. What issues do we need in that general permit? And what are those conditions that we need to apply to satisfy those private landowner issues? So it's not an easy thing just to say it's good or bad. The devil's in the detail, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, my colleague from the mother county is absolutely correct. However, looking at the same paragraph, Paragraph 3511801, you're amending subparagraph D, subparagraph A. First sentence of that says that the director has to issue it in 60 days. And I'll read you the second paragraph, the second sentence of paragraph A. Understand the Senate's being asked to amend subparagraph D. In granting permits, a director may impose such conditions as may be necessary to accomplish the purpose of this act, which are not inconsistent with the existing rules, regulations, and standards. The director has 60 days. He can already do exactly that, the detail. But what they're asking you to do here is say, nope, we want a new category. We want to cover all the country from our meadow to the Montana line. I ask you to vote no.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I don't pretend to be an expert in this area. I've been listening to my friends on both sides of the bill, and I think they've all of them got a good argument. Mr. Chairman, I'm an aye vote in committee of the whole on this bill. As it stands right now, I'm probably a no vote on third reading. And let me explain. My model of what's going on here after listening to everybody is that you had a court decision that protected some individual rights that was wise in the particular case at hand, but had some sweeping system implications that get us in trouble. And it will be an obstacle to not only the oil and gas business, but many of the other interests in this state in conducting the economic activity that they need to if this state's going to prosper. At the same time, there's a very real issue of individual rights, particularly landowners, other interests that can be trampled on in individual cases if we're not careful. And what I think the bill does is it takes the system problems that have been created, deals with them, but takes it a step too far and will hurt the individual landowner. And I think, Mr. Chairman, this is a classic case where the art of good legislation is the art of compromise. And that's why I want to keep the bill alive in Committee of the Whole. Because I think that there may be, if the parties of interest can come together that understand this thing, and I tell you, I do not. I think there may be a reasonable compromise that can achieve everybody's objectives that can be had. And I would hope we could try to work that out. And if we can't work it out to everybody's satisfaction, then maybe it ought to wait for a further interim study. Perhaps one, I don't know, you management council can pick a committee that they think maybe would look at it with a fresh set of eyes. I don't know. They may say no, it needs to be committee of the people that are used dealing with it and experts. That's a judgment they would need to make. It sounds like we have a real problem to fix. It sounds to me like we haven't reached the necessary compromise to fix it well. So, Mr. Chairman, let's see what we can come up with in this area that would be a reasonable compromise of the very valid interests on both sides of this argument.
Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Bebout's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 85, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no.
No.
Passed. Senate File 85 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 86. Will the reading clerk please? Oh. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
As soon as I find you here. Mr. Chairman, I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You heard the motion. All those in favor, say aye.
Just
those opposed, say no.
Answer my question. Is it?
No, air quality is not involved.
It isn't?
No.
How do you know?
Because it's not in that part of the law.
But it's in the general permits, I read.
Yeah, but it's not air quality. It's only dealing with water. Water district.
Reading clerk will read the committee the whole report.
I can tell you the specific standards. We asked that question. Air quality, they'd like to do it.
Mr. President, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. Senate File 25, do pass amended. Senate File 30, do pass. Senate File 32, do pass amended. Senate File 33, do pass amended. Senate File 35, do pass. Senate File 39, do pass. Senate File 40, do pass amended. Senate File 45, do pass amended. Senate File 47, do pass amended. Senate File 52, do pass. And Senate File 85, do pass. Senator Cooper, Chairman.
Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I move for the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That motion is carried. The report has been adopted. I understand we have some messages from the House.
February the 20th, 2012, from the House of Representatives, message 121, Committee of the Whole indefinitely postponed. Mr. President, the House adopted the Committee of the Whole report failing the bill listed below by the vote indicated. House Bill 28, Environmental Quality Council Executive Secretary. Ayes 27, noes 32, excused 1. The bill has been indefinitely postponed. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Report from standing committees.
February the 20th, 2012, Mr. President, your committee number 4, Education, to whom was referred Senate File 98, reports back with the recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Barnard, Cole, Jennings, Landon, Rothfuss, Senator Cole, Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, it appears that our desk has been cleared.
Mr. President, members of the Senate, tomorrow we'll have the budget bill on Committee of the Whole for the first day. It's our intent also to have, once appropriations is met, to deal and they have Senate File 105 in their committee. My hope is to have that on General File also. We've got some heavy lifting to do now. And so as we move through, be mindful of your debate, be mindful of the time. And with that, Mr. President, I move that the Senate stand adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning, Tuesday, February 21st.
Senator Geis.
Mr. President, I have two announcements. You have this card on your table. Those of you that do not know and understand what state lands are all about and who owns them and why they're not public lands, there's a meeting in the Hersler Building in 1699 on Thursday the 23rd to educate you all about state lands. That's the first. The next one, Mr. Chairman, your Agriculture and Committee Number 5, Agriculture, Public Land, Water Resources, will meet tomorrow night, and we're going to take up Senate File 65, Applied Agriculture Research Funding Program, Senate File 76, Water Beneficiary Use, Senate File 49, Terms of Youth Board of Ag Members, Senate File 55, Purchase of Federal Lands, Senate File 64, Criminal Trespass, Senate File 106, Transfer of State Lands.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. President. Here, Committee Number 1, Judiciary, will meet on Wednesday, February the 22nd. Please note the time, committee members, at 7:30 a.m. in room S1. The reason why it's 7:30 is that'll be our last day for committee on Senate files. I believe the last day for bills to report our committee is Thursday. And so that Wednesday will be the last meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee to deal with Senate files. So that being said, we'll consider the following bills. We'll finish up Senate File 81 on Medicaid fraud recovery. And then we'll proceed to the last four bills that we have. Senate File 70, Child Abuse Reporting Penalties. Senate File 72, Foreclosure and Probate. Senate File 73, Termination of Parental Rights. Senate File 99, Guardian Ad Litem Program.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. President, Committee Number 8, Transportation Highways and Military Affairs will continue its grueling schedule by taking up Senate File 68, Time Limits for Veteran and Dependent Tuition and Fees, up in S-14 at 10 minutes past the hour of 5 o'clock.
Senator Hines.
Mr. Chairman, Committee Number 3, Revenue.
Bill, that's yours.
15 minutes after the new recess. We will take up 7582 AEMDs and 7582 cigarettes.
Thank you, Senator. Senator, Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. President, Committee Number 12, Rules, will meet on Wednesday at noon to consider the Revisor's Bill. There may be other committees meeting at that time, but Revisor's Bill shouldn't take too long.
Senator Bebout.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, your Committee Number 9, Minerals, will meet Wednesday, February 22nd, 15 minutes after the noon recess in Room 302 to discuss Senate File 93, Casper Aquifer Land Acquisition, and if time allows, Senate File 102, State Lands Management.
Other announcements. Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. President. The Appropriations Committee Number 2 will be meeting upon adjournment tonight to consider Senate File 42, Large Project Funding, Senate File 57, Education Accountability, both those referrals, Senate File 107, Public Works Contracts, and Senate File 105, School CapCon.
Other announcements?
Yep. We're not.
I'm sorry. Go
Thank
ahead.
Thank you. On tomorrow morning at 8 a.m., we'll be considering Senate File 34, Medicaid Option Study, Senate File 58, Health Insurance Exchange Study, and Senate File 37, Medicaid Waiver Funding. Tomorrow, upon adjournment, we'll be considering Senate File 59, Public Employee Retirement Plans Option Increases, Senate File 87, State Employee Compensation Commission Membership, Senate File 18, Reimbursement for Livestock, Senate File 97, Wyoming Retirement Act. And on Wednesday morning, we'll be considering Senate File number 2, the Appropriations for the Legislature. That's the Feed Bill. Senate File 66, Medicaid Assistance, Hospice Care. Senate File 78, Interstate Compact on Students of Military Families. Mr. President, that should be all bills that we've received so far.
Thank you. Other announcements? You heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The Senate shall stand adjourned until 10 o'clock, 10 a.m. tomorrow morning. We are adjourned.